like to welcome you to the Mesa City Council study session for Thursday, September 11th, 2008. I'd like to excuse Councilmember Dennis Kavanaugh, who's out of town and unable to join us by phone. First of all, this says, Vice Mayor said it's been a long morning, but a great morning. We started out at ASU Polytechnic for their grand opening, or whatever you want to call it, the celebration of their new buildings. And we have renamed that to ASU Polytechnic Mesa. Dr. Crow has not gotten that memo yet, but it will be forthcoming. We're really proud of that and proud of you. And then we just finished the police and fire, joining the police and fire departments for the 9/11 memorial, which was very well done. We appreciate that. We'll begin this morning by hearing a presentation and on discuss and provide direction on the public or private and public liability trust fund, including insurance renewals for the upcoming year. Ms. Spinner.
Thank you, Mayor. Good morning, Mayor and Council. We are going to talk about the insurance renewal. We have every year we come before the council in November to renew our insurance policies with regard to excess liability insurance, property insurance, and aviation insurance. So we're going to talk a little bit about the trust fund that the city has established to pay not only for the premiums but also the liability claims that are paid from the fund. I have with me here today Barry Hegrenis, our risk manager. We also have our insurance broker, John Chino, if you have any questions as we go through. Now, the Property and Liability Trust Fund was established many years ago. It is funded by the city through the general fund. What we pay out of this fund include the liability claims in cases, the attorney's fees and litigation costs for liability claims, and we pay all insurance premiums, or those three insurance premiums, I should say, from the Liability Trust Fund. Here you can see the contributions that the city has made over the years. And since 2004, it's been fairly consistent, $4 million to $4.2 million per year go into this trust fund. And here you can see the liability claims that are paid from the trust fund. Typically, we pay about $1 million to $1.5 million per year for all of the claims in cases that are paid from this fund.
Ms. Spinner, excuse me. You said that these are their contributions per year to the trust fund, to the
yes.
liability trust fund? So what would the balance of that liability trust fund?
Typically, it's around $9 million, Mayor.
I'm a little confused then.
Pardon me?
I'm a little confused at the math then. If we're putting in $4 million a year, but the total payments, liability claims, and cases paid, are those the cases paid out of that trust fund?
They are, Mayor. To this, you need to add the insurance premiums that will show is about $1.2 to $1.5 million per year. We also pay the litigation costs and the outside counsel costs, which varies from year to year. We have over the years tried our best to keep as many cases in as we can, and we have that information as well, how it used to be about $500,000 per year that we were paying for litigation costs and outside counsel. That dropped significantly since 2001. This year actually seems to be a little higher because of some litigation expenses. We also pay from that that trust fund the cost of maintaining the liability team. So this is the 3.5 attorneys, three staff members, and the risk manager. Their salaries and benefits are paid from that trust fund as well.
Could I, at some point, could staff provide me with a reconciliation? Because my math still isn't working up, because I'm looking at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, 20, almost $30 million that have gone into this liability trust fund over the last 10, 11, 12 years. Mr. Odom, maybe you could shed some light on this, but I'm looking at maybe only $12 to $15 million of claims, and I'm wondering if, okay, you got an answer? Okay.
We typically maintain this fund at about $12 million a year, just for the peaks
balance,
and balance.
The ongoing balance.
Correct.
$12 million a year.
Yes.
Okay, and as we're going to get into the self-insurance, those are on a per case, on a per occurrence basis. I know we haven't
that's
gotten
correct.
There yet. But
that's so. Correct. It's per occurrence.
Per occurrence. Okay. So yes. we try to maintain a $12 million balance in the trust fund. Okay.
Right.
Thank you.
All right.
If I could still get that reconciliation.
I'm sorry?
The reconciliation, just so I can get an idea of what's going in and what's coming out of that. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Mayor, the next slide is the shows the insurance premiums that we have paid per year since 1999, 2000. And you can see it has steadily increased, and it peaked in 2006, 2007. Last year, the market started to soften, and we not only were able to save about $200,000 from the total insurance premiums paid, but we also increased our insurance coverage. So we are anticipating this year that the market is still soft, probably not going to realize the level of cost savings that we did last year, but hopefully we will realize some cost savings. And as you'll see, we're going to recommend that we go out into the market and we look to increase our policy limits as well to see, give the council the cost-benefit analysis back in November or in November and allow the council to decide what those policy limits should be. So that's the Public and Liability Trust Fund. Now narrowing it just to the liability coverage, as I said, we purchase excess liability coverage, the property insurance coverage, and the aviation coverage. The excess liability insurance coverage, this deals with third-party liability claims that are filed against the City of Mesa. We are self-insured up to $2 million, which means for every claim that is filed, the City of Mesa will pay the first $2 million of coverage. Beyond $2 million, our self-insured, our excess carrier will cover that. Since 2001, we've not made any claims under our excess carrier. So our rates have tended to reflect that we have a pretty good loss history.
And Ms. Spinner, we use self-insurance retention and deductibles, and I know that there's a technical difference. But in reality, in layman's terms, those function basically the same way, right? You pay the first X dollars of a claim, and then your insurance kicks in. So they're really almost interchangeable from a practical standpoint. Is that correct? Okay, because I know we use these in this report a lot different, and so everyone understands, there is no magical difference between the two as it relates to operation. Although technically and legally, I understand in insurance terms there's a difference.
Thank you. Okay. So that's on the bottom end. We have a $2 million self-insured retention. On the upper end, our policy limits now are $35 million. And as I said, if I remember correctly, last year our policy limits were $27 million. So although we were able to save about $200,000 in our insurance premiums, we also were able to increase our policy limits from $27 million to $35 million for excess liability coverage. So that's what we have this year. We have gone out to the other cities to see, okay, where are we in relationship to the other cities? And you see that information in the report. We're fairly consistent, especially with regard to our self-insured retention level. We're a little below Phoenix, but on the upper end, we're more towards, a little bit towards the bottom. So what we are recommending now when we go out into the market, we're still recommending a $2 million self-insured retention level. But we're recommending that we ask for bids for policy limits of $35 million, $45 million, and $50 million so that we can bring all of that information back to council and let council decide what is the best in terms of the cost-benefit analysis for that insurance.
If I could ask a question, are we choosing the $2 million because that seems to be the norm for what our neighbors are doing? Or is there we're only paying $1 million something a year, so it would seem like to lower it to $1 million. I mean, what does that do to the rate? And to raise it to $3 million doesn't seem to do us any good because we can we'll wipe out our entire savings in 1 year.
Right, Mayor. We have been kind of looking at that every year. This is the first year we're actually recommending we stay at $2 million. What we've done over the past couple years is we looked at $1 million, $1.5 million, $2 million, and $3 million. And you're right, Mayor. Back when the market was very tight and rates were continuing to go up, we did increase our self-insured retention level as a cost savings. We have bought it back down to $2 million. Last year we accepted bids or sought bids at $1 million and $1.5 million, and we saw that the cost savings wasn't, actually there was no cost savings. We have to pay more because we are buying down insurance. The cost was fairly extreme, and I can ask John Chino to come up here if you want some more details on that. But we recommended and the council agreed that the $2 million seemed to be the right fit between the cost-benefit analysis. Also at $1 million, you know, any claim that may exceed our excess limit, we then have to provide information to the insurance carrier, and then they have the option to come in, and they don't take the defense, but then they provide a lot more input on how the case should be defended and what should be done and what the settlement recommendation should be. So there's more administrative involvement at that point. But really, why we have chosen and we're recommending $2 million is based on the last 2 years of history when we have gone out into the market and we have asked for different bids. We found that the cost-benefit analysis, we were better off
so
at $2 million.
You believe that $2 million was the sweet spot, so to speak?
Yes.
Okay.
Mayor, I guess I'd like to know, do you want to ask for council direction now? We're done with excess liability insurance. Do you want to stop now, or do you want me to go into property, and then we'll do the recommendation?
Why don't we handle these separately, just so we can keep them a little bit? Are there any questions?
Yeah, you know,
Councilmember Higgins.
Thank you, Mayor. I just don't understand one thing you just said about at what level does the insurance company get more involved in what you do?
Whenever we have a case that reaches the value that it may reach excess liability. So if our self-insured limit as it is now is $2 million, anytime we have a case that possibly could go above $2 million, we start notifying the carrier. Here's a case where they are seeking damages in excess of $2 million, so you need to be notified of this. As the case progresses, and it looks like, well, the case may reach into the excess layer, then they become much more involved in the administration of the case.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Okay.
And I guess to follow up on that, what you're saying is we look at our liability claims period, we're hovering around $1 million to a plus a year, and what you're saying is that if we go down to $1 million, number one, we don't get the trade-off in cost versus our additional, we're getting additional insurance coverage, but you're saying it's not a good big enough savings to add in the fact that if we're having these $1 million, $2 million, then a lot of cases fall in that range where we would have to include that as part of the review, administrative review, versus $2 million, most of the cases stay under that amount.
That's correct. And actually, if we buy down to $1 million, the cost will go up.
Right, because we're buying more coverage.
Correct.
Gotcha. Okay.
All right. So, Mayor, what we're recommending is that when we go out for bids in the next couple of weeks on our excess liability coverage, that we use a $2 million self-insured retention level, and that we seek bids for policy limits at $35 million, $45 million, and $50
million. Hey, any objection to that, Council?
No. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Okay, next is property insurance. And the city estimates we have approximately $600 million in property assets that's covered by this insurance. We also have, this also includes boiler and machinery insurance, which means if we have a boiler or a piece of machinery that fails, and that failure creates secondary damage to some other machinery, this policy will cover that damage as well. We currently have coverage at a $50,000 deductible and $200 million total loss per occurrence. In the last, I think since 2001, we've had two cases where we have sought reimbursement under this policy, and we have received compensation or coverage for that loss. What we are recommending now is we're recommending that we go out and test the market a little bit more in property than we did with the excess liability. We're recommending that we seek deductibles at $50,000 and $100,000, and that we seek policy limits per occurrence at $200 million and $300 million. So under property, you'll receive a number of different bids, and we'll be able to weigh the cost-benefit analysis based on the various options.
I guess this is where the technicality comes in as far as the difference between self-insurance and deductible. Are our deductibles paid out of the self-insurance trust, or is that something outside of that?
Mayor and Council, the deductible would actually be paid by the individual department that had the loss. It would come out of their budget. And then when the claim payment came back, I'm sorry, go ahead.
It ends up out of this. At the end of the day, it comes out of the trust.
We have some set aside that's just what we call part of our citywide appropriations that take care of those issues. It does get charged to the program that incurred the loss, but we have a centralized appropriation for that money.
Okay, so as we're determining what amount the balance in the trust, in the self-insurance trust, we would take into account the potential deductibles that come with all these other insurance programs?
No, we'd balance that on that citywide appropriation, the outside portion that we have, the $2 million I believe we have set aside for.
So whereas the trust, we reserve an amount every year to maintain that $12 million balance.
Yes.
On the deductible, you're saying it's an annual appropriation, an annual budgeted amount to cover the deductibles.
That's correct.
And the reason for that, is that a technical legal, or is that a business reason that we do that?
We're going to leave that question with Chuck, Mayor, because I'm not sure Barry and I
It's a resource issue. I mean, we maintain, make sure that we're balancing what we're incurring against what we think our exposure risk is.
Okay. Isn't that what the insurance trust does, is cover your exposure?
Yes.
So I guess what I'm asking is, if we're budgeting on an annual basis, the actual cost under this property insurance.
We could move the entire appropriation to the trust fund.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if
it's a wash as part of the impact to the general fund. It's just a matter of you're going to take it from
that's what I'm trying to understand.
Or take it from the liability pot. It's still going to be the same.
Okay, that's just what I understand, is that we're not double counting. We're not having an insurance trust that's set up to cover this, that we're also taking.
No, sir.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
So, Mayor, if we can get direction on our recommendation on the property coverage.
Councilmember Summers.
I have a feeling that Dave and I are going to have the same question. We have $600 million in total assets for the city, property assets, and we're looking at a policy limit of $200 million per occurrence. It seems like a lot. Do we have any one asset that would be $200 million that we would want that level? I mean, we're in a community. We rank the safest community next to Milwaukee. Ground doesn't shake. We don't flood. It's not likely we would see a wiping out of a lot of our assets at the same time. I'm curious, would we see a significant reduction if we went down to $100 million?
Councilmember Summers and Mayor and Council, it's a correct observation from the standpoint of, is one peril or incident going to cause more than $200 million worth of damage? Given the risks that we know about in our geographical area, the answer is probably no. The amount to carry roughly 40 to 50% of your insurable assets is pretty standard, but it's definitely, there would be a cost savings to bring it down to, say, $100 million, for example. What that savings would be, I wouldn't really be able to tell you, but it would be an option we could look at.
But this is where we could find that out. We can set it at $100 million and see what that looks like.
We could ask at 100, 200, and we could even do 300 if you wanted to. I would say, what we're looking at here is the likelihood or the possibility of a major catastrophe, a gas explosion that has catastrophic.
Well, a gas explosion even. I'm just trying to, how do you wipe out, with a $600 million, trying to wipe out one-third of the city's property assets is highly unlikely, even if a dam breaks, and I've seen the modeling.
What's that?
Even if the dam breaks, Tempe is in trouble, but Mesa being a table, we're doing all right. But I'm curious as to how much maybe a $100 million policy costs, and then have a conversation about whether maybe we should just
Mayor and Council, we could do that. I mean, think about fire. Think about monsoons. A wastewater treatment plant will easily consume this up. A arts center will easily get close to this number. A building like this, I mean, there are scenarios where, 200 million maybe that's probably catastrophic, but a fire certainly could be.
It could be in the 100 million pretty quickly.
But I'd say we'd be over 100 pretty quickly on
some. Let me ask you this. We'll go back to the insurance premiums. Is that the total cost of all insurance premiums? Or is
yes,
that just
it is,
excess
Mayor.
Liability?
I do have it broken out if you'd like me to put it up on the Elmo.
If you could, please, because I'd like to see, because once again, what are we paying to buy that extra $100 million?
Mayor and Council, this is John Chino, our insurance broker. He may be able to add some information.
My recollection, the difference in price at the $100 million and $200 million was less than $5,000.
Oh, okay.
And I would expect that going into market this year, it probably is going to be the same. And it gets back to your point, Councilmember, that this is such a safe area that the carriers are competing very aggressively to get this business because they know how safe it is. Well, they've got the price down to such a competitive rate, all they can do is pile on limits same price.
Yeah, what you're saying is that what Councilmember Summers is saying is the insurance company agrees.
Exactly.
Agrees
they figured it out.
There is little risk in this. So what we're saying is that for $5,000, even though that risk is infinitesimal, it's pretty cheap insurance to go from $100 million to $200 million.
That's exactly correct.
For $5,000. And if I had known that our insurance carrier was here, I'd have said, the safest city in America, anywhere, nothing ever happens here.
I'm just the broker. But I will relay that to
perfect,
the carrier.
Perfect.
Yes.
Mayor and Council, I've put on the Elmo the list of how much we have spent per year per type of insurance, so you can see. You can't see this? I will copy it and have it provided to you. I can read at least this year.
Well, just you know, give us the property, just the total cost of the, for example, the property.
Okay, for okay. Property, I'll go back to 04-05. It was $307,000. In 05-06, it was $360,000. In 06-07, it was $267,000. And in 07-08, it dropped down to $200,000.
Okay, so for $200,000, we got $200 million of insurance with a $50,000 deductible?
That's correct.
Okay, gotcha. All right, any other questions on this particular one?
Do you want me to seek bids at $100 million, or are you comfortable with $200,
$300?
$200, $300. I think we're comfortable. Anyone, I think we're comfortable at $200,
$300. Okay, next is...
Yes?
It wouldn't hurt to have a broad range. Just, I think it's illustrative both for us and
underwriting is involved
and for the public.
How difficult would it be? Why don't you get a price just to make us feel comfortable? That's a good idea.
Okay.
So 100, 200, 300.
Okay. Okay. Mayor and Council, next is airport liability insurance, and this covers third-party liability claims arising from airport operations. And this is Falcon Field. It's really, you know, runway maintenance issues. It could be a slip and fall in the terminal, an issue like that. We have coverage right now, and we purchased this because the excess liability coverage excludes airport issues. So we purchased separate insurance. Our current coverage is zero deductible, so they take it from $1. As soon as we get a claim, we just send it over to the carrier, and a $50 million per occurrence policy limit. What we are
I'm confused as to why we'd have a zero deductible on any insurance, less this one.
Well, I can tell you that's one reason why we're recommending we just go see what the cost savings would be if we bumped it up to $1 million deductible. But it is relatively it's inexpensive insurance. In 07-08, we paid $24,000.
So is this a combination of liability and I guess it's really not property casualty, but it's you know, if we have a plane that hits a pothole in the runway and is destroyed, then we're buying a new plane for somebody.
Yes,
and we're found negligent. We're buying a new plane for somebody.
Mayor, that's correct. It would cover some sort of premises liability issue because we are the managers and owners of the airport itself.
And since planes that land at Falcon run from 20,000 to 20 million, I guess we do have some $20 million planes that land there. That's why we'd have the $50 million?
Mayor, also not to mention bodily injury that could
okay,
come
so we have the liabilities wrapped and included in that.
Correct.
Okay, so to get back to the question as to why we'd have a zero deductible.
I believe it's mainly because it's relatively inexpensive. It's $24,000 in 2007, 2008
okay.
to go all the way to zero deductible.
All right.
Now, we haven't had many claims, and we haven't had any major claims, but...
So what you're saying, though, is that, you know, understanding that it's probably not going to go to zero cost, I would imagine, $24,000 where we were last year. So if we went even to a $50,000 deductible, we wipe out our total cost in one claim, which is why we're at zero.
That's right, Mayor.
You just answered my question. Okay.
But we will
I'd
go.
I'd still like to see what that is, though.
Okay. Well, what we're looking for is zero deductible and $1 million. If you'd like to change it and go lower than that, we can do that too, Mayor.
I don't know why we'd go to $1 million if the total insurance cost is only $24,000.
Okay, so where would you like us to have the deductible?
I didn't even know even $50,000 deductible. Once again, you have one claim and you've wiped out your total cost. So, and you got to figure that in a given year, you might have one claim.
And there are claims. They are, you know, to date we've been lucky. There have been small claims because they do a good job out at Falcon Field. But claims can happen at any time in the lawsuit.
$24,000 is a total cost of $50 million of insurance with zero deductible.
That's right, Mayor.
Okay. I feel comfortable with staying where we are then. Okay.
Okay, then we'll just stay with, we'll just do zero deductible and $50 million per occurrence.
Councilmember Richens?
Just for clarification, Williams Gateway Airport Authority takes care of their own insurance.
That's
out
correct.
There, just so everybody playing the home game knows.
Mayor, if I might ask, on the policy limits, do you want us to ask for $100 million just to see what the cost would be?
At $24,000, I don't see where it would hurt. Because like I said, one Gulfstream that comes in there can wipe that out pretty quickly. So.
Okay. So we'll do zero deductible and policy limits of $50 and $100 million.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about that I can understand with airports is that I don't, even though you have a little small claims, when you have a big claim, I can see it being really big.
Right. No, you're right, Mayor.
And like I said, one, you know, Gulfstream 4, Gulfstream 5 is a $50 million jet in and of its own, and we haven't even covered that.
During the Super Bowl, we had some special events happen out there. How's that coverage for those special events factor into what we're doing here?
Councilmember Richens and Mayor and Council, that any type of special event that would occur on our property would be covered for any of our negligence that might occur in relation to those events. But typically, we would require the applicants, if you will, that are having those events to provide us with proof that they have insurance for their activity.
As an additional insured.
With us as an additional insured, correct.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Mayor and Council, next is aircraft hull and liability insurance. And aircraft hull insurance covers the city's aircraft and equipment for property damage loss. This might be the police department's helicopters or aircrafts and any equipment that we place into that aircraft. And then the aircraft liability coverage will insure us against any third-party claims arising from the operations of that aircraft. So that side will cover if the police department helicopter causes personal injuries to someone else and we're found negligent and responsible for those damages, this policy would cover the city of Mesa for that type of situation.
Could you give us the cost of that last year?
I can. The cost last year was $130,000.
Okay.
And that actually dropped in 2006-2007. It was $194,000. So it dropped significantly last year. Right now, we have a deductible of $25,000 in motion. That means if the aircraft is moving, we have a $25,000 deductible. If the aircraft is not moving, there is a $1,000 deductible. And the policy limits are just the stated value of the aircraft. So we get a depreciated value of the aircraft that's damaged. And for the aircraft liability, so the injuries caused by the aircraft, it's a zero deductible and $50 million policy limit.
Okay. Do we have the same situation we have here with the other one as far as the costs? And I have the same question about zero deductibles. And also a low $1,000 deductible. I mean, I'd like to know what the differences are. I don't know that a zero to 1 million seems like a pretty big jump.
John, can I ask you to come up and talk about?
Now, $130,000, was that for both coverages?
Yes, Mayor.
Okay, so we're talking $130,000 for both coverages.
Yes.
Okay.
Hey, John. Hi. I'm sorry. Mr. Mayor, what was the question?
The question was, we're talking about, for example, the $1,000 not in motion on the hull coverage, and also then a $0 deductible on the aircraft liability. And if we're paying $130,000 for total coverage, I'm just wondering what these low deductibles, if we raised them, what kind of impact that might have.
These policies are sort of similar to, you know, your own personal auto policy, unlike the excess policies that we were looking at earlier, where there's a lot of variation and choice between deductibles, self-insured retentions. These tend to be more standardized. It's rare to have an aircraft liability deductible. I mean, we're recommending that we look at it to measure the cost, but you would rarely see a deductible associated with an aircraft liability policy, which is why there hasn't been one, although we're recommending that we look. It's a good time to test it. The $1,000 not in motion deductible, again, it's a standard. It's what you would see on 99 out of 100 policies. I couldn't tell you what the difference in cost might be with those, but
I feel comfortable. Does everyone feel comfortable with the proposals as far as getting quotes on 0 to 1 and 50 to 100? Okay.
Thank you.
Let's go ahead and move ahead with those then.
Okay, Mayor and Council, that's all we have, unless you have any other questions.
No further questions? Thank you. Appreciate it. Ms. Spinner, I guess you stay there.
I stay here, Mayor.
We're going to hear a presentation, discuss, provide direction on procedures for council committees.
Yes, Mayor and Council, we thought it might just be helpful to discuss briefly the council committees, since the council committees are picking up now and beginning to meet. I think it was last year, 2 years ago, the prior city council decided to form a committee to look at what did they want out of the council committees, and were we accomplishing the intent of the council in what issues should be sent to the council committees, what type of information we were looking for from the council committees. Also some questions regarding, well, how would items be placed on the agenda for council committees? So we formed, we amended the statute, or I'm sorry, the code dealing with council committees, and then the council also approved some policy guidelines on the intent on how these council committees should function and operate and what would be expected of the committees. Certainly this council can take a look at the code and the policies, and we can make changes if this is not the desire of the council. But really, just go through it quickly. I think you all know the council committees are subject to the open meeting law, just like the full council. And the tricky thing with the open meeting law with a council committee is that because there are only three council members on a committee, two of you cannot talk about any issue that is likely to come before that committee. So whereas with the full council, four of you cannot talk to one another unless we're in a public meeting. With regard to council committees, any issue that is likely to come before that council committee, you should not talk to another council committee member. Okay. In terms of placing an item on the agenda, you can see an item can be placed on the agenda by the chairperson, by two committee members, by the mayor, or by the city manager.
Just kind of.
Yes.
It's mayor. I'm sorry.
Fire away.
It just seemed like an odd.
A little conflict there.
It can only be placed by two council members, but they're not supposed to. Now, so I'm guessing they can just say, "I'd like to have this issue on the committee," and that's where it.
That's correct. What you should not do is engage in a substantive discussion on the merits of that issue. You can also obviously tell the city manager or the staff liaison that you would like an item placed on the committee agenda, and the city manager or the staff liaison can convey that to the chair. But you're right. You can talk to another committee member. I would like this issue on the agenda. Should not talk about the merits. And Mayor and Council, the only other thing that is a little different, as you can see in the guidelines, it's generally what kind of issues will go to which council committee. But we also have decisions of the council committees, which is section 4 on the guidelines. And this is one of the issues that the prior council discussed. What happens if the council committee recommends denial of the request or whatever issue, that we don't want this issue to go forward? Well, does the committee have the authority to just stop that issue now and it doesn't go forward any longer, or would it just go to the full council with the recommendation for denial from the committee? And what the council decided is that the committee would have the authority to stop an issue from going forward. So if the council committee decided no, or recommended denial on an issue, the issue did not come forward to the full council. So it required an affirmative vote for it to make it to the full council. The only exceptions were utility fees and anything else required by law that the full council had to vote on. So that's one little difference. Now, well, I'll leave it at that. That's what the prior council requested.
Are there any other charter issues that override that?
No, because if there was a charter issue, so if the council had to decide an issue, this policy statement says, well, then it has to go to the full council.
Councilmember Higgins.
But that's something, just like any other issue, that if you get other council members, you could put it on the normal council agenda, even though it didn't come out of subcommittee.
That's correct. And the mayor could also place it on the full council agenda. You could also, you know, realistically, at the committee, even if you're opposed to it, you can obviously make the statement, I'm going to vote in the affirmative to move this forward to the full council, but at that time, I'm not sure I'm going to support it, you know. But the intent now is if there is a recommendation for denial, it will not come forward to the full council.
Automatically.
Yeah. Automatically.
Councilmember Richens?
We did get a nice list of the council committees that we're in, but I noticed in working in your report, it talks about working with staff, and it would be, I think, really helpful to have a list of the staff members that were assigned to that committee as the staff liaison. I didn't have that.
We can get you another copy.
At the bottom of that other, I think it's at the bottom of the last.
Is it? I didn't see that. Okay. All right. Great. Thanks.
They came out.
And I assume, Chris, that has both the city manager staff and the city attorney staff that works those committees?
I believe so. I know it has the city manager staff signed, but we could add to that the city attorney's office. But it had, once the mayor made the announcement about the committee chairs, then we followed up with a list of the staff liaisons for each committee. But we can send that back out again. Okay. Along with city attorney's rep, too.
Okay. Any other questions for right now? Thank you. I think we.
I got it.
Any more questions or comments right now? I need to digest a little bit of this. There's a fine balance that I believe we need to have between this body as a whole was elected to make decisions for the city, and I think there's a fine balance between the efficiencies that are provided through committees and abdicating responsibilities to a subgroup of the council.
And, Mayor, as I said, we can change those policies.
Yeah, and I just haven't got a grip as to, and we'll need to probably bring it back and discuss a little bit further what that balance might be, because, you know, a lot of it is just in how we administer it, and how we as a council work that. Vice Mayor?
Well, as Debbie just described, going through a committee process, if the committee decides they want to move it forward, then it automatically goes on the agenda. However, like any item, for a full council agenda, it can be placed on the agenda by the mayor, by the city manager, or three council members, regardless of what a committee does.
And I understand the logistics of that, but the process is something that I just have to think about. And you know, once again, it's this council's decision, but it's something I think we need to be aware of, because even with that, do you hear it one time? Do you hear it two times? How does that process work? And like I said, I think the council committees, as I understand them, we're meant to create an efficiency, which I think is important, so that we're not, as a whole council, we can't have the kind of discussions that maybe a smaller group can have. And I don't know that we want to get bogged down in bringing everyone in to talk about every little issue. And so from that standpoint, I think it works really well. And the purpose is absolutely understandable, and I think it works well. But we'll talk about it a little bit more.
Okay.
I mean, for right now, it seems to be working, so. Okay.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you. Item number three, hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on the proposed planned community district for the Mesa Proving Grounds. Laura, Mr. Wesley, and Mr. Sheffield.
Morning, Mayor and Council. We're going to work with you this morning to talk through the community plan document a little bit more as I get into this presentation. I'm glad you've got your books there. We're going to have you look through them, so get them ready to flip through them and find some of the information that's in there. We've got a couple of staff members here to help me out with some of the details I might not be able to explain as well, and we also have the applicants in the audience that I'm sure would be glad if you have questions for them as we go to help provide explanation. As I go through this, feel free to interrupt when you do have questions so that we can help address them. As I said, the purpose today is to help familiarize you with this document. It is a thick document. It's going to be on your agenda for September 18th for introduction and October 6th for approval. And so we want to help get you as familiar with it as we can. So the way that we're going to try to do that this morning is to walk through a hypothetical review process. We've got a hypothetical development unit plan for you to look at and how we will review that, and also a site plan for you to look at and how we'll do that. We're going to be using development unit 2 out of the community plan for that process. And also want to just mention that this whole process includes not only the planning and zoning side of things, but also includes the potential for modifications to some of the engineering standards. When you see this on your agenda for the introductions and approval, you'll have the zoning ordinance part of it, and you'll also have an ordinance for those modifications to the engineering standards. We're not going to be referring to those engineering standards today. We're going to let the city engineer, transportation engineer, handle that at another time. So The overall process, again, is the development of this community plan sets the stage for all the future development that occurs on the property. As we go through subsequent reviews, everything will be, is it consistent with the community plan? So establishing the community plan that we're happy with, that we think will work for the area, is a very important part of the process, because everything else comes back for consistency with the community plan. When we look at a development unit plan, we'll be given a development unit land use plan, development unit design guidelines, and updates to the master plans. So with development unit 2, it's a little bit south of the corner of Elliott and Ellsworth. Right at the corner is development unit 1. Just south of that along Ellsworth is development unit 2. So here's a potential layout for a street grid for this particular area. With each of these development units, they will provide potential land use groups that can be developed in the area. So here's an illustration where we might have the urban core land use group. This hatched area represents where the general urban might go. I see a question coming already. Yes, ma'am.
I'm not following when you say development unit 2. Are you talking about that in this book, development unit?
Yes.
Unit 2?
Yes. If you go to, I probably should have maybe even started there, but if you go to
4.9.
If you write page 422.
Oh, it's not
the document.
2, like section 2, site and content.
No.
No.
Chapter
okay.
4, page 22. So 422 shows you all the development units.
Okay.
For there, there are 9 of them that are proposed. And again, for our example, we're using number 2.
Great. Thanks.
So we've got potentials for urban core, general urban in the hatched area. Just added some more hatch in that south east corner. I'll do that one more time so you can see that hatch come in. Potential for district land use group, and then finally for the civic space land use group. So this map constitutes the land use plan proposal for this area. Have a note there also in the corner that the open space OS land use group, which is this little parks and plazas, could come in at any point through the site plan process. So with that, as we review the development unit, one of the first things we need to know is this proposal consistent with the intended character for the development unit as it was established in the community plan? So to determine that, we go to Section 8, specifically Section 8.4A on page 8.3. And there we see a listing. There's a map again that shows all 9 of the development units. And then A through G give a brief description of each of those units. Particularly, we're doing development unit 2. So section A gives a description of the northwest area, those two development units, and talk about the fact that they are to be very urban type areas with not much restriction on height and so forth. And so as we continue to review this development unit, we need to keep in mind this is supposed to be a pretty urban area. And so we'll be looking to see, are they indeed, with their plan, proposing an urban-type development unit. The next step would be to look back and see what actual land use groups were proposed in the community plan that could go on this property in this development unit. So if we turn back to page 7.5, and that's section 7.3, you see a map there that shows each of the different types of land use groups and how much of those land use groups can go in each of the different development units. And you'll see varying amounts. You'll see some development units that don't allow any of the land use groups, and some, like the open space, that can go anywhere. But if we look through and see what development, what land use groups are allowed in land use group 2, you'll find in the second box down on the right-hand side that there, with the lug D, which is a district, shows some shading in land use group 2, so we know that that, or in development unit 2, so we know that one can go there. And then if you look on down to the bottom left, you'll see the GU, or general urban, is allowed in that DU2, or the, yeah, DU2, and also the urban core is allowed in DU2. And so if we look back at the original DU plan, we can see that each of the land use groups proposed in that plan are allowed by this chart, so we know that's okay from that perspective. Next, we need to know, because there are various amounts of those land use groups that can be allowed in each one, does this plan meet those allowable limits for the amount of those development units, those land use groups that can go in that development unit? Hopefully I don't get those terms screwed up too much. If it gets too confused, let me know.
But if we turn back to the last page in Section 4, it's where the land use budget is. And it shows us by development units. Yes, it's a big chart. There's actually a larger version back in the back, and I might should have highlighted that one. But if you look in that chart, you see each of the development units listed down the left-hand side. And across the top, you see the amount of residential allowed, the amount of the non-residential square footage, and then the amount of each land use group that's allowed in the different land, in the different development units. So if you look at development unit 2, it can be up to 60% of the district. It could be all general urban, or it could be all urban core. And so as long as the plan fits within those parameters, then it's acceptable in terms of those groupings. We'd also be looking at how those are arranged to each other as a kind of a logical sequence. The whole idea of the forms and the transact is you're moving from more dense to less dense, and if something's providing for that smooth flow, we would maybe want to adjust those limits a little bit, but the basically meeting the types of districts that are allowed. It also would refer you back to the open space and the civic, because they're pretty much allowed any place. There's not a specific amount shown for those. There are also some footnotes at the bottom that tell us overall about some of these characteristics and amounts of development that can occur.
Mayor, I just have a question. John, so what that says is the only land use is the D, the GC, or GU, and the UC. We couldn't come in and say, hey, I want estate.
Right.
Correct. Only what's in there.
That's correct.
And so if there's like 60% of someone comes in with a district, the other 40's got to be made up of like GU or UC.
That would be correct.
Awesome. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
And you'll see in some of the other districts allow for a little bit more mix of uses. But these urban core ones are pretty well specified. And if you look back to the left, in terms of the amount of development that can occur, you see a range. In DU2, we can have anywhere from 390 to 2,000 dwelling units. And we're ultimately going to see someplace between 50,000 and 5.5 million square feet of non-residential space. One of the questions that may come up would be, in that land use plan, there were shown overlap in the different land use groups. It's not a hard and fast line at this point in the process of where those groups are going to happen, because we're allowing that flexibility as the market and particular projects come up. So we can look in 5.1A there on page 5.1, one of those criteria for the development plan. It makes it clear that that's possible, that there can be that overlap. We're looking for general locations of land use groups at this point. When we get to the site plans, that's going to have to be specified exactly which land use group they're building under, so we can evaluate those site plans.
So, John, since it's site plan driven, then that's something that the applicant will actually decide rather than us trying to figure out exactly. We'll look at it and overlay it to see if it's in the general area or it substantially conforms with it, but the applicant will determine that, right?
That's correct. I think the only concern staff would have if we had one is we start seeing too much of a checkerboard nature of these land use groups, because, again, we're supposed to establish the forms that kind of transition to each other. We would maybe start getting concerned, but other than that, kind of however they come out within these parameters will be good.
Councilmember Summers?
Looking back up page 23 in Section 4, John, I'm looking at some of the notes that are in very, very tiny print, so that I think Councilmember Richens and myself are the only ones that can read it.
But that's okay, because I think that those on this side are the only ones that understand it.
That's because it uses small words.
Oh, okay.
This is just going to be a tennis game if we keep going. Okay, now I'm going to try to put myself back on track. Dave ran away from me. Note number one.
Okay, real quick, Councilman, before you go on. Back in Section 19, there are a little bit larger versions of all these charts, and if you want to see the little bit larger one, it's not page 19.7.
So I didn't have to go that far. I can.
For those of you that might be a little bit more challenged, Section 19, page 7. Go ahead.
So we're looking at a maximum 15,000 dwelling units.
Correct.
We're looking at a maximum square foot of non-residential use of 20,000 square feet.
20 million.
20 million. I'm sorry, 20 million. Yeah, I don't want to make that mistake. All right, how would we define
non-residential? Is that all job use? Would that include the aggregate of a fire station or a public library? Or, I mean, how did we define non-residential use, for one? And two, what is the job impact? Because one of the key issues with this area is to maximize the number of jobs. So we have 15,000 dwelling units. What would that equate if we wanted to keep at least a one-to-one job ratio so that every employable person in 15,000 dwelling units would have at least the opportunity to have a job in that area? Is that 20,000, 30,000 jobs? And how do we, can we reach the dense, that level of job growth with the minimum of non-residential use? So I think there's a handful of questions. What is the definition of a non-residential use? What's the minimum non-residential use, and does that support a higher job-to-resident ratio, which is one of our targets for this plan? I love throwing three questions out at the same time. I'm sorry.
Let me.
If you miss something, I'll let you know.
Councilmember Summers, I'll try to. Well, okay. I'll try to take them one at a time. In terms of the minimum square footage. Oh, I'm sorry, what's the definition of non-residential?
Yeah, let's start there.
Let's start with that. The residential is basically defined as anything that's exclusively residential. Mm-hmm. Okay? So if there's no other land use in that particular building or that particular site other than residential, it would count against the dwelling unit count. If the site is a mixed use or anything that would be considered non-residential, which would be office, industrial, any kind of retail, any kind of commercial, a hotel use, any of those types of activities are considered non-residential.
Okay, if we had an honest-to-God mixed-use, real mixed-use development, let's say it had ground floor retail, a couple of floors of office, and then residential above that, would we be splitting the difference? So many residential uses, it would all be considered? It would
all be considered non-residential.
Okay. And
can I ask a question on that question,
Councilmember Higgins?
Thanks. Right in that sentence, though, it doesn't sound to me what you just said. It said if the residential is demixed use, which the residential units count against the total number of dwelling units, but you just said the opposite. I understood you to say.
That's yeah. the side of the table.
Okay. I mean, I'm sorry. I thought that was what we had understood, but you're right. That's what it does say. So, yes. We would end up. We would end up.
What's the yes. Okay? So what's the desire? I see some nodding out there. Yes. Is as it written?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. That's good.
Okay.
So.
now I'm confused. So. Who's right? Is what's written what we intend?
Yes. What's written is right. Okay.
All right. Okay. So we would actually split the difference. Then the yes. residential would count to the residential. The commercial would count to the non-residential. Okay.
So Grady, you said what's written is right. Well, I'm not sure if it's right, but it's as written. You intended, it's right? Okay.
Okay. I apologize for the confusion. In terms of the minimums would be the addition of all the minimums that are listed under all the development units that you see there. So if you were to add under the second column from the left, all of those minimum dwelling units together, and the same thing for the gross floor area of non-residential. All
can we
those
throw buildings. It up on Elmo so people who are, what did you call it, Dave?
The
playing the home game can see what I'm referring to as far as the minimum, maximum, sure. Me.
No, is what I'm hearing is that it's designed to try and be self-determining, self-controlling, because you have the minimums, you have the maximums within each dwelling unit. And therefore, once you hit that maximum, it's supposed to create somewhat of a balance. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes.
And for those playing the home game, they can't read it either. Yeah, high definition 50-inch TV. We're going to the sports bar to figure this one out.
Maybe if we got the larger version.
I don't know.
He's going to see. He's going to.
There's a bigger one. While you're looking at that, let me ask this too. Let's bounce this question. Let's assume the maximum residential, because we are looking for the urban feel here. 15,000 residential units, what would be a fair estimate on the number of jobs that would be required in this area to have a one-to-one, one resident to one job ratio?
Mayor, Councilmember Summers, I'm not necessarily current on that number. I'm wondering if Mr. Dibjeni has it or not, but I would think we're looking at someplace between around 25,000 jobs, because I think per household we're probably looking at around 1.5 average number of.
I'm going to assume we can hit that with 20 million square feet, but when we add up the minimum number of square footage, do we even know if that will get there? Because that's about 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. I'm thinking it's about 9 million square feet minimum. 9 million. 8.55 million. See, I rounded up. 9. We're going with 9. Will 9 million square feet get 25,000 jobs? And I guess a greater question is, if it does, is 25,000 jobs the minimum we are? Is that our minimum goal? Or are we shooting for 30 to 40, 50,000?
Mayor, Councilmember Summers, in terms of the major plan amendment, which has done projections on those types of numbers, what they're shooting for in terms of numbers of jobs is over 50,000 jobs for this area.
Okay. And so if it builds to the minimum, and we're going to be about what? Are we hitting 30 with the minimum, or are we going to fall short of the minimum with minimum?
Mayor, Councilmember Summers, that's something we'll have to go do some
calculations on. We've got some numbers for that.
And look at that. But you're talking a little bit less than half, so it is getting, you probably are someplace around 25,000, 20 to 25,000 jobs at the minimums.
And the other thing I would like to throw in here from a personal note is I mean, one-to-one is a minimum ratio. I'm hoping to import jobs here so that the number of people who live here less than the number of jobs. One last question, if I may, Mayor. I'm curious, when I look at the minimums and then I look at the maximums on that sheet, in order to get that level of square footage on the maximum side, I'm going to assume here that the level of infrastructure that we need, water supply, sewer, et cetera, is going to be greater than the minimum. Are we going to be establishing, are we going to be placing the infrastructure in place, the major infrastructure in place, so that the maximum can be accomplished over time? Because we're talking about a 40-year process, building this up over time. One way to make sure that that happens over time, that growth doesn't skip this area, is to make sure that the infrastructure is sufficient for the maximum growth. So are we going to make sure that the infrastructure like that is sufficient to the maximum growth of 20 million square feet?
Mr. Brady?
Oh, I got the
answer. And Mayor, the city engineer can answer, because the part of included in here are the master plans for the utilities. And so it's not only having the master plans match the maximums too, Beth, talk about that, but it's also the commitment of when does that infrastructure actually get built into the system so that it's in place, you know, the timing, I guess, is of the phasing of the project.
Mayor, Councilmember Summers, let me give you a brief overview of how the infrastructure and the master plans are set up. We are reviewing 5 master plans right now that cover the entire 3,200 acres project. And those master plans are establishing to build out maximum density today. Mm-hmm. And then, so when we're done with those. Yes, my understanding is to the LUG.
Or maximum, yes. Okay.
Yes, maximum densities. Now, that being said, we are doing that right now. We've got 5 master plans that we're reviewing. We'll be coming back to talk to you about. As time progresses, what we know is that development will change and that we will need to phase infrastructure. So today, we know kind of what the first 2 development units are going to be. When each of those comes in, kind of the way I look at it, is the 5 big master plans that I'm reviewing now is kind of the umbrella that covers the entire site. And then for each of the 9 development units, we will again see a master plan that's specific to the development unit. And it's to do a couple of things. One, review the sizing of the infrastructure based on what they now know will develop in that unit. And 2, phase the infrastructure such that it's built in a way to support everything that's built to date, plus what they're proposing to build.
So we're not putting an infrastructure coming in 2 years later, ripping it out and upsizing it.
That's the intent.
Okay. I'm sorry, go ahead, Mr. Councilman Summers.
But is it fair to say that we're going to fall short of developing the infrastructure or the core infrastructure to the maximum so that it would support the maximum, so we're not coming back in 10 years and ripping it out and replacing it?
Yes, the intent is to develop to the maximum, to size it for the maximum, and then as each unit comes in and we know what's going to get built, then to review the size, rerun the models, and analyze.
I think what I'm hearing is that the max, we have two maximums here. We have the maximum in numbers that are sitting on this page. We also have the maximums that will exist by how development actually occurs.
Right.
And what we're saying is that we have the maximum on the page, and if this were reality, that's what we would build out. As they submit a plan for a specific area, you'll look and see what is going on right now, how does it affect, how is reality played out
right.
within this table?
Mm-hmm.
And we will then develop to the maximum potential based on the reality of that time.
Exactly.
Okay.
Is that maximum potential, what's the maximum on the GFA for non-residential?
It may not be.
Well, it may not be because, you know, for example, if it'll be within that range, but it's whatever you could max. Let's say, as I understand it, let's say you get halfway through a unit, you've developed, let's say, to the maximum of residential. That would then affect and take down the potential of what could happen on the remaining half. And what you would do is make sure that the remaining half was developed to whatever maximum could be built.
Right.
Correct.
Is that,
that's the way I understand.
Is that explain what it is?
Yeah.
Could be built to the
based
maximum.
On the plan, or could be built 30 years from now?
Well, as this evolves over 30 years, it could be built to how reality fits in with this with the plan.
Right.
Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. There's one more point to make, though, too, Mayor, and that is if you add up all the maximums down those columns, you'll get more than 15,000 and more than 20 million square feet. They planned each one a little higher than the maximums to give them kind of that room to push things
around.
Okay,
so we could end up over-engineering based on those individual parts. When I say over-engineering,
giving flexibility.
We would constantly hit the maximum potential is what it's geared to do.
Right.
Right. And then as the plans come in, then we adjust based on what we really know. And I think the other thing that John pointed out was, you know, it will add up to more than is at the bottom of the table. And I think what they're looking to do, too, is that, you know, some of that may shift between development unit based on what is viable to sell today, what's the market bearing.
Well, I like the term over-engineering, though. I want to make sure that the infrastructure can be a choke point for growth beyond the number of jobs. So we might set the number of jobs in the next 20 years might be 25,000. The potential in 40 years, which is when this is all supposed to be, that's kind of the end game for this entire site, might be 40,000. Well, there's a heck of a lot of land beyond this parcel in Pinal County and some other areas where if the infrastructure isn't there and there's a lot of money to have to tear up infrastructure and put it back in to support going from a three-story building to an eight-story building, development might just choose to skip over that and go to the newly formed or newly privatized state trust land in Pinal County. I want to make sure that we over-engineer, to use that term, so that we are naturally drawing some of those additional jobs in without creating that choke point in the infrastructure. I want us to be planning for the maximum number of jobs, the maximum number of residential units here, so we're not coming back in 20, 30 years to have to tear that out. I don't want it skipping us to
right.
go somewhere.
I guess, Mayor and Councilman Summers, I think as a question we kind of struggle with is this is going to be phased, it's evolving. So the requirement, even though they may come in initially with one plan, it may be not quite what it will ultimately be at the end of a 30, 40 year period. So I think that's where we have to be careful that using the word over engineering period is we don't want to build into or allow to build an infrastructure that can't accommodate ultimately the growth that's anticipated here. Now what that means though is it means whether it's the underground utilities or the streets and how they're laid out, we're gonna have to find that balance between what the market is suggesting it can support at that time versus putting pressure to build that infrastructure maybe at a higher capacity and a certain style so that it can accommodate, you know, it has to be just a little bit more maybe in order to allow that growth in the future to accommodate without having to reconfigure everything in the future.
Then we have to find that balance between building for what we've planned for now and over-engineering to the maximum point where we might never get, and strike that balance that will allow us to grow. And actually, you're looking at something that's designated an urban core. We should have infrastructure that would enable it to be an urban core.
Right. Mm-hmm.
If the sucker goes on steroids and grows to a real, I mean, a city urban core, then sure, we're going to have to invest in some more infrastructure at that point. But we should allow that to grow to an urban core to what this vision is.
Well, let's get back to the nuts and bolts. Now that we've had this philosophical discussion, does this plan it's an important discussion to have, but does this plan, in your opinion, accomplish establishing the framework that we've talked about, where it can not only allow, but basically set the stage for that type of thing?
We are currently still reviewing all the master plans, but what I have seen so far and what we are talking with, we're still in discussions with them. You know, there's still some technical details.
But philosophically,
that's where we're headed.
Okay, yeah. You agree with what
I agree with
concerns
what
of Councilmember Summers and what Mr. Brady said,
right,
about allowing this balance and to go forward.
Right. Now, you know, the one thing to remember is that we go forward, some of these may actually be redeveloped as some are developing. And if you look at downtown Phoenix as an example, they did not have all the infrastructure in to support the new stadiums and the hotels and all those things. And you come in and you put parallel lines in. And
the truth of the matter is the easiest way to choke off all development is to require such a large upfront infrastructure costs that I can guarantee it'll never be built.
Exactly.
So, you know, it's our responsibility to create that balance where we provide the marketplace the opportunity to thrive while still keeping in mind the ultimate goal and not allow it to underbuild where we end up with the same result that it chokes off development down the road for a different reason.
Exactly.
Okay. So you believe that we're on the right path.
I believe we are.
Okay.
Right now.
And Mayor and Council, I think we're going to have a follow-up session. That Beth will lead on those master plans.
And Alan Sanderson, our city traffic engineer,
as well,
because there are some things we're talking about doing differently here that establish a certain character for this infrastructure.
Okay. Mr. Wesley, you want to continue on now?
Be glad to.
Thank you.
Are you done?
So as we continue to review of the development unit plan, one of the things we have to look at are the streets and the street types that are shown. With the community plan in Section 10, there is the information about the different street types. In particular, on page 10-7, there's the basic street system, the grid system that the traffic engineer has been evaluating. We'll talk more to you about in the future, but it's laying out those district and arterial streets. And so the question is this development unit plan maintaining that basic street network? You can see development unit 2 is bounded by what's shown on here is Mesquite and Warner, and then Ellsworth and Spine East. And so, you know, is that plan maintaining that street system? Then in addition, at the development unit plan level, they're supposed to start giving us those more detailed street network. And so we would be looking at the street types as shown on page 1030 in section 10.7 for the street types to be laid out to create the type of environment that we're looking for here. And so you can see that description of these different street types, a little bit different than you normally think of. I mean, we usually talk about arterials and collectors and locals. Here we're talking about the arterials, the primaries, and the secondaries. And it talks about that kind of that balance between the traffic and the pedestrian and what the expectation is for that street type. And so at this DUP level, they need to put in those streets, show us where they're going to be, and the types.
Councilmember Richens, you had a question?
Yeah, if you could real quick point out the transit plan and how transit is incorporated in with some of the design for the circulators, buses, possible future light rail. Where in here is the transit plan?
Mayor, Councilmember Richens, at this point there's not a specific transit plan proposed. Mr. Sanderson can address that maybe a little bit more with some of the discussions the traffic transportation department's had with him about that. But there is language in here about planning for and being prepared for transit use in the future as the
where
densities and activities.
Where is that language found so I can review? Make sure I review it.
Yeah, up in 3.
Is it in 3?
And what would be interesting,
we can get into real detail on this. I know Mr. Dimitri is a huge proponent of transit. So.
Well, on transit, for example, if we could identify at least some potential corridors, and what would be really nice, if we could plan infrastructure so that we didn't have to go back and completely rip up everything and move utilities. I mean, it can be engineered to where, for example, the middle of the road is kept clear of major infrastructure except for at certain points, so that if, for example, 30 years down the road there was light rail that went down that road, they could easily go in and not have to move major lines like we've had to do in Phoenix and Tempe and here.
Mayor, Councilmember Richens, one of their concepts that we've been hearing quite regularly is rather than a few big streets where you have to accommodate these different things, and that way they're planning for many smaller streets. And one of their ideas is that we will either be able to accommodate that transit within those existing streets, or over time some of these streets may become a little bit more specialized with vehicle versus transit versus pedestrian, but it'll be that multitude of streets that will accommodate these different activities is their concept.
I think I'd just like to see a little bit more detail that spelled out, that kind of thinking towards transit and bus pullouts and future streetcar. Or I know it's difficult to dream up what technology is coming next, but there's a lot of interesting transit type infrastructure that I think could be incorporated at least in the plan in some conceptual stages. Thanks.
Okay. One of the next items that we'd look at the development unit plan stage are the parks and open space, and are they consistent with the community plan? Section 11 of the document talks about parks and open space. In particular, there's the concept of a great park that is to be a feature in this development. Going to pages 10 and 11, you can see that concept illustrated in the map on the right-hand side of a concept of where that park might be as it runs along those central streets. And then on the left, some concepts in terms of pictures of what those types of activities might be, the character of different elements of that park, from some pretty quiet, passive, natural areas to some much more active uses that could occur within that great park. We can see by looking at this that there's an intent that the park would probably extend up into Development Unit 2. And so we'd be looking for that in this particular development unit. Indeed, they did show the civic space land use group in the southern portion of this particular development unit. So it looks like that's being accommodated in the development unit plan. In addition, the plan anticipates a number of neighborhood parks and plazas, and those are illustrated in the pages before that within this section 11. You can see the illustrations on pages 3, 4, and 5. That demonstrate the different types of parks and plazas that could occur throughout the development. Given that this is a more urban area, we'd be looking at more of the urban-type parks, more hardscape-type areas and plaza-type areas that would be the likely types of development. But this gives us some concepts of the characteristics of those parks and plazas we could expect to see in this particular development unit. With the general urban and urban core land use designations, those particular groups are meant to be pretty urban type areas. So in addition to having our traditional setbacks that we normally think about where we've typically tried to be pushing buildings away from the street, here we're real concerned about bringing the buildings out to the street, making sure the street's being engaged. So we talk about a Bill 2 line that's brought up in Section 5.1A. They're required, if they're using one of those two land use groups within their particular development plan, that at this stage they need to designate those build two lines along each of the streets. So we'd be looking at this development unit plan for the establishment of those build two lines, which is basically a maximum setback. Then in the street, our street design plans provided and consistent with the community plan. One of the things that we've discussed a lot with this particular development is the streets from the city perspective are really going to drive this development. And are we achieving that character and that quality that we're after? And so what are those streetscapes going to look like? At the development unit plan stage, one of the things they will do for each street is show us specifically what different streets will be like. And just as examples, they provided in the book on pages 1038, 1039, some examples of what streetscape characters will be. And so we'll be looking forward, whereas these are just illustrative, we'll be receiving specific plans for the different streets within the development unit at that stage. And then finally, at the development unit plan stage, we'll be receiving development unit design guidelines. In the community plan, Section 8 is titled Design Guidelines, and contains an outline of the types of information that we'll receive in subsequent design guidelines for each of the development units. But also, as you've seen through these different illustrations throughout the document, there are a lot of design guidelines scattered throughout. But specifically with the development unit plan, as stated in Section 510B on page 5.1, they are to provide us more detail in terms of design themes, open space, pedestrian corridor, signage, streetscape concepts, lighting, general architectural styles, et cetera, that will come in at that stage of the process. So they'll take these general guidelines and make them more specific so they can gear them urban design guidelines versus more residential guidelines or district guidelines as the character of the different development units are established.
Mr. Wesley, how's it anticipated that the design guidelines would be monitored, governed, whatever word you want to use as the project goes forward? What's the anticipated process for that?
Mayor, as individual site plans would come in, that would be one of those tools that we'll take a given site plan, compare it against those guidelines, and are those guidelines, those standards?
So that would be part of an administrative function?
That's correct.
Step, okay. Councilmembers, Mr. Brady.
But following that through, though, once reviewed the site plan, but beyond that, what other oversight might there be? Is there any other review?
In terms of after the project's built, we currently have standards in the city code for maintenance. There are some in here for maintenance long term of.
Well, does this okay? As far as rebuild and is there a master's? For lack of a better term, master association, a master sub-governing body that would act as an association or as going forward?
Yes, Mayor. There's a couple of ways that's covered. There is a required by the PC district that there is a master developer for any PC district. There's a master developer who's overseeing all this, maintaining the land use budgets and so forth. Section 4.6, one of those right in there, talks about project governance and gives us a little bit of information about how they are going to be setting up a number of subgroups, HOAs, if you were, or commercial property maintenance groups that are overseeing the development. And
that will be their successor to the developers. So long after the successor, and for lack of a better term, an HOA type of a thing that will then govern after the developers.
There will always be the master developer. There will always be that master developer, but then there will be other groups in support of the master developer reviewing the construction plans for conformance and doing that long-term maintenance.
Okay, what I'm concerned about is after the master development is done in a dwelling, in a unit, 5 years after there's no new construction going on, now that starts evolving, what's going to happen when the next wave of development or redevelopment comes along or in maintaining developments come along?
The development unit design guidelines will stay established for the life of the project, so all future development will be reviewed for compliance with those design guidelines at a staff level. And then one of the project governance criteria we have set is that a letter be provided from the HOA or the master developer that the projects submitted to the city do comply with their guidelines as well.
Okay, so if somebody, let's say since we're using two as our example one, let's say that the street's been built, everything's landscaped, 10 years later, someone doesn't want to come in and do a new building, they just want to change a facade on a building.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, is the city going to be once again reviewing that as part of that building portion? Or let's say they just want to change it from green to pink.
Well, from green to pink, I think what triggers a review at this point in time, if something requires a building permit, are there safety issues, are there building code requirements? If a permit comes in, then these guidelines would be reviewed for that. But if it's painting a color from one to another, I actually don't think we've gotten down to that level.
I think
we don't regulate
that.
We
need to address is the long-term governance of this.
Right.
Because I'm not sure that the city wants to get in the middle, and right. I know people don't like HOAs, but we're establishing major standards, and I think we have to have some kind of mechanism in place that ensures that long-term that goes.
Yep.
Councilmember Summers, I'm sorry, Mr. Wesley, I cut you off here.
Sir, just real quickly still. On page 4.8, or 4-8, section 4.6 provides project governance, some of those bigger picture items that we were talking about in terms of how they anticipate setting up some different entities to help with the implementation and maintenance on their end. And then section 6 with regard to site plans, talks about site plan modifications and those administrative changes. And so we would consider these like we do any site plan or DR board approval if there are changes that
well, I understand that, but once again, I'm talking about a non-city involved process.
Right. And that's 4.6 we'll talk about.
Okay, you know, somebody's going to be taking care of common area landscaping, these right. parks, these things like that. So I'm assuming that there's some sort of requirement that there be a sub-governance right. set up to handle a community governance type right. of thing. Okay, Councilmember Summers, and then Vice Mayor.
Let me take that maybe a little bit different step. I'm going to assume that and I hope that the city of Mesa would not get overly involved with something when somebody changes from a brown building to a pink building. It's none of our business. But one of the issues that we had discussed in prior meetings was that the density of this project would increase over time, over 30 to 40 years. So let's say that DMB has done the initial development in unit DUP2. We'll keep with that example. And once they do that development, that property then transfers to a private ownership. It's not going to be DMB anymore. At what point does this master plan no longer come into effect? There's a lot of leeway in this plan as far as design and construction. The city's very much hands-off in this. Once that property transfers to the private sector, if somebody decides, as been given an example, we're going to increase density by eliminating surface parking, we're going to do underground parking, we're going to build the structure up. Is the city now once again involved in the typical zoning process, design review, site review, elevations, the whole thing?
Mayor, Councilmember Summers, we would be at site plan review. And based on the criteria, we're going to talk about site plan review in just a moment, it would either be a staff or a P&Z function to review that site plan amendment.
But that's consistent with, this is the governing document.
It all has to be consistent with the community plan and with the development unit plan.
Forever and ever, once that's we correct. Put this in, just like zoning is vested, this will become a vested legal governing document that will then, regardless 30 years, 40 years from now, unless this is amended, this is the document that governs.
That's correct.
For whatever P&Z or staff.
Regardless of who the property owner is.
Okay.
So we're not.
So once it's transferred to private, this still remains a governing document, but they would have to go through a rezoning request, I would assume, if they wanted to change zoning. If an individual property owner in this area wanted to change his zoning, they'd have to go through zoning change, and how does that change over time?
Mayor, Councilmember Summer, that's a real good question. One of the things they would have to do also would be to change the general plan designation, because with the mixed-use community, the only zoning district that goes with it is PCD.
I was going to say, isn't this the zoning? This is the zoning, so there's not a zoning change.
Well, the zoning is planned community.
Right.
That's technically, we talk about this as if it were the zoning. Technically, it's not the zoning because the city zoning is still the city zoning. The PC zoning district, if you look on a zoning map, that'll be the zoning for the property.
Now, as someone comes in, though, and they look at it, the since this is basically a form type of a thing, which, once again, we're not getting into, this plot has to be this, it would be taken in context. The request to build whatever building it is would be taken in context of this plan for that dwelling unit, and then all the minimums and maximums and all that table looked at, and all the standards would then apply to that subsequent, and I don't even want to call it a zoning case, land use item.
Yes.
Mr. Sheffield.
I think I can help clarify a little bit. What happens with this, once they rezone the property to PC, each of the development units will have sub-districts, for lack of a better term, called land use groups. And that's when we get into the district areas and the village areas and the estate areas, the urban cores, and the general urban areas. All those are consistent, our land use groups. Each one of those has a different characteristic. If for some reason when the development unit plan comes in, when the development unit plan comes in, certain areas will be designated. And as John showed previously, there might be some overlap in that. But when the actual site plan comes in, they have to declare the land use group at the time of site plan. Okay, they have to say, this site is this land use group. And if someone buys the property later on and says, well, I don't like that land use group, I want a different land use group, that would be an amendment to the development unit. And we'd go back through the process based on whatever the process is for that development unit. So there's six of the development units that would go back to the Planning and Zoning Board. Three of the development units would go back to the Planning Director as an amendment to that development unit.
But once again, within this framework.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, this is what we're signing off on, and this is the framework that will govern this property.
Exactly.
From now until this is somehow
it runs with the
changed
land.
Amended. So, once again, it'll be taken in context of what's around it and the overall dwelling unit and even the overall community. Everything will be put in context for that individual property, and will be governed or analyzed and judged based on that.
Exactly.
Okay. Donna?
Mayor, if I could just clarify, when you use the term vesting, that's probably not the word that we would use. Yes, it's just like any other zoning case. That zoning applies until it gets changed.
Well, and that was what I was referring to, all the other ones, okay? Yeah, I understand that. I'm just trying to, what I'm trying to get, and I apologize for throwing out a legal term, what I'm trying to get at is that this is it. This is not just a DMB document. This is a city land. DMB just happens to be the developer and the first landowner. This document will apply to it. It goes with the land, therefore it applies to any landowner, any land use that goes from now, five owners from now. They'll still come back to the framework that we've established in this community plan. Yes.
That's correct.
Is that an accurate statement?
That's okay. Correct. This is the zoning for
okay.
the property.
Councilmember Higgins?
What I don't understand, I heard Gordon say, if someone wasn't happy with the land use group, they can come back and request a change. That's what you just said didn't make sense to me.
Okay. The zoning district is PC for the overall site. Within the PC district, they have a community plan. The community plan breaks the area into sub-areas called development units. Each of the development units will have a separate plan. Okay, within each of the development units there are even smaller areas of land that will be classified based on something called a land use group. Okay, and that's what the plan that John had showed earlier for development unit 2. For the most part, there's incredible flexibility within each of those land use groups. So I wouldn't anticipate a lot of changes to come forward. I would anticipate most of the developments will likely be able to fit somewhere within the flexibility of each of the land use groups. But if for some reason they don't like the land use group, it's an amendment to the development unit, not to the overall plan. It's an amendment to that specific area for the site that's governed, for the development unit that governs that site.
Well, like we were using land use, or DU2,
right.
And it had three possible choices.
Right.
And it had 100, 100, or 60, and you mm-hmm. could mix them up anyway. You're saying that there is a capability of changing
of the... The change they would be requesting would have to be consistent with
those
three things. And so if they had, for example, they had an area that their site plan had declared to be a district log, which is one of the three that's there, and they wanted to change that to general urban, that would be a land use change that would be consistent with the development unit plan, but it's a lug change, for lack of a better way to describe it, a land use group change.
What section was that we were just looking at with that big chart? Was that section 9?
The land use budget?
Yes.
Section 4.
It's at the end of section 4. There's a small one. You can go back in section 19, 19.7, I believe it was, for the larger one that's easier to see.
Because I still don't understand what I'm sorry I'm being slow today, but I still don't see, like, if we just use that, again, that land use, mm-hmm. the DU2, and there's only three lugs we could have.
Right. You can use district, urban core, or general urban.
Right.
And the development unit plan will specify where those three things are located. Okay. And so it's not going to be the entire development unit's not going to be district. The entire development unit's not going to be general urban.
Okay.
There are going to be three different ones parceled out accordingly. And so there may be someone who doesn't like where the general urban is placed. They want general urban to be on their property.
Okay.
So it's one of the three that's specified for that development unit. It may not just be the one that's designated for their property. And so that's the one that they want to change. They want to go to the one that might allow a higher density.
But the overall governance of that will be on this little section, the 60,
correct.
The 100, the 100.
Yeah. Any changes they have still have to be consistent with this chart.
Got it.
Let's
that makes sense.
Throw something
Thank
else.
You.
Let's say that 25 years down the road, 20 years down the road, that I understand we have the three subgroups, lugs, within the mm-hmm. district definition. 20 years from now, the market's changed. What then is the process if somebody says none of those three lugs apply anymore? The market has changed. I don't like to say the word I don't like it.
Okay.
That really the market will dictate. What then would be the process if someone comes in and says, I'm in district unit, I'm in two, development unit two, none of the lugs apply anymore. I want another lug, something that's outside that's not currently allowed in two. What's the process at that time?
Mayor, Council, in Section 4, which sets up the community plan process, also has procedures for amending the community plan. So that's what we're talking about at that point, is amending the community plan. And so we have definitions of major and minor amendments.
So an applicant would have to come in and say, I don't like any of these three lugs. I want to go with another lug. They would have to then bring back the entire community, put it in context, and say, here's why I believe that in the context of the entire 3,200 acres, I believe that this works, this different lug works. And they'd have to go through the process through planning and zoning and the whole bit and come back.
It would come back to council.
Because it's a community plan. Vice Mayor?
As in all land uses, nothing is permanent. It can be changed down the road. But what we have to do by setting up this framework that we're doing right now is giving guidelines, say, for what the foreseeable future is right now. These are your guidelines. These are the parameters we're working in. You have a general layout, and then you put a layer on that narrows it down, a layer on that narrows it down. You have your choices. You work within that framework. Down the road, if you want to change, there's a process where you come back and you can request it to be changed. Mm-hmm. And it would have to be determined by whoever is in charge at that time. And so we're getting a little bit too bogged down for me here. It's a basic framework, and it's being well thought through, and I think we're on the right track to make it work well.
Well, I agree with you, Vice Mayor. I think the one thing that is different from this is that this is not a general, like someone has a 5-acre parcel right now. They can come and literally they're looking at
just change theirs.
They're just change theirs. And what we're saying is if they're in DU2 and they want a different lug, they literally have to bring in the entire 3,200 acres. And so it's the same basic process, but the standard is much higher because they have to put it in context of the entire community plan.
Right.
If they want to go outside what was originally approved, if they're going for a community plan amendment.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, major okay. Anyway.
Next item.
Okay, Mayor, moving on. Just real quickly, the review process then for developing a plan once it's submitted. Pre-submittal by staff, as is typical with any process that comes through. Section 5.3 specifies the citizen participation and notice requirements. That's on page 5.5 of the plan. And then in this particular case, DU2 is specified to go to the Planning and Zoning Board for its review and approval. Again, there are three that are recommended or proposed that staff would approve, the ones that are more lower intensity, mostly residential areas. The higher intensity ones are planned to go to the P&Z Board. So that would be the process then for actually getting approval of that development unit plan. So unless there are any other questions about development unit plans, we'll try to cover the site plans here and go through that process a little bit. We won't be able to be quite as specific with those because we don't really have a detailed site plan to look at to do this. But the basic, the final process, is, as the Vice Mayor has just pointed out, we've got the big picture with the community plan. We'll have the next layer of the development unit plan, which it has to be consistent with at higher level, just refines it down to that more specific property. The final stage is the actual platting and site planning on a specific piece of property that has to be consistent with those higher documents and what's been set out there. The site plan and design review process are being proposed to be rolled into one process and either be approved by the P&Z Board or staff. We're looking for that consistency. The requirements for submittal with the site plan is the site plan itself, designating the specific uses, and then the land use budget tracker and site plan development potential that we'll talk about towards the end. So here's an example site plan for a corner in this area. You can consider that arterial street on the left to be Ellsworth and the primary streets just being one of those east-west streets we saw coming off of Ellsworth into this area. This particular case, we're estimating a 3.6-acre site, a two-story office building in the corner, approximately 20,000 square feet, and they're going to designate the urban core land use group. This particular lot could have been either urban core or general urban. They've picked the urban core. So which land use group? Urban core has been selected. So what does that tell us? We can get some basic information. We go to Section 7. About each of the land use groups and what is expected with those. And if we go to 712, which is on page 738, we can see then what are those standards we're looking for with regard to development within the urban core. And you can see there's a number of categories that we have to look at. what's the general character, what are the typical uses, the block character, the circulation, the street character supposed to be, so we can examine any given site plan to see that it's consistent with these. Within these statements, we have some general character statements. If we look at just in that first box under the general character, we have a basic character statement that says structure and hardscape dominate the landscape. So we're on page 738. And so that's just kind of a general character statement. We also have in there, in the next sentence, that buildings are close to the street with parking areas behind or beside. That's a regulatory statement. So as a site plan comes in this area, if they've got the parking out in front, we can say, no, not permitted. It's got to be behind or beside. So these help in both those regards. Then as we turn the page, you know, we'll come back to this, but we've got some general pictures, too, that give a visual an impression of what that quality and character development is supposed to be, and we can use those also as evaluation tools with individual site plans. Just,
excuse me, Mayor.
Councilmember Higgins?
John, is it going to be, that's a pretty hard and fast, someone can't come in and say, oh, I don't agree, so I'm going to appeal it to the council for something like that? No, that's it. Okay, thanks.
Typically, also, we have bulk standards, the setbacks and lot coverages. That's provided for in this plan on page 742, section 713. You look down that chart, you were used to seeing things like 15-foot, 20-foot, 25-foot setbacks. You look through here, you're seeing 2-foot setbacks and 6-foot setbacks. Talking about an urban condition with the development here. We've got lot sizes that are pretty small, trying to keep things packed in pretty tight, but we'll use this then and looking at those site plans and how they're being arranged on the sites given the lug that they're in. And then also something that we don't typically see if we turn the page again, pages 743 and to 45, or 44 to 45, the vertical setbacks. Mm-hmm. As the buildings get taller, how are they stepped back then to keep from providing too much of a canyon down the roadways? You'll see that they, again, reflect that 2-foot setback from the street potential. Behind that, though, they often have an arcade if they're coming out that close, so you provide for that pedestrian circulation, or they've got to be stepped back even further. And so the ones on the left-hand side are the more urban ones. The ones on the right are the village district primarily, but also the general urban in terms of those setback standards. Any questions about that? Because we don't usually see that. So we'd be looking for buildings based on that.
We appreciate that you provide us with pictures. We like pictures. Pictures are good.
In large font.
Color pictures, no less.
They're nice, aren't they?
Good.
Mayor, if I could point out something that might be somewhat illustrative. If you go through each of the pictures, particularly the ones through Urban Corp down to about the district, you'll find that there's a picture of a Target store in each one of those. And the idea is to show the form of a big box as it would basically transition from a district all the way through the urban core, and including in this urban on say page 741, third picture down on the left side, you'll see a Target that's done in an urban condition, so that there is a way to do a big box in an urban form.
So continuing with that site plan review, we'd again be looking for consistency with the guidelines that have been established through the community plan and with the developed unit plan. We'd be looking to see what they're proposing in terms of any on-street parking, and that's provided for in Section 10. We look at pages 10-6, 10-8, 10-10, and see those illustrated in those diagrams based on the street type. With our particular example, the site plan is for property right along Ellsworth, which would be the 6-lane arterial street, and we see well, there's no parking allowed on that street, but on the side streets, we could look at the other particular diagrams on 10-8 and 10-10 for those neighborhood streets or the service lanes and what type of on-street parking might be allowed. Again, we've got pictures that illustrate what that should look like in terms of the overall streetscape and character, the landscaping, those things that would go with that. What landscaping requirements do we have for developments? Development unit design guidelines are going to provide us some more detailed information for the specific situation. But if we look on page 12.2, in section 12.2, we have, again, some illustrations, some pictures of what to look for in different settings. For the type of landscape, you'll see some varieties for very urban-type situations. We've got a lot of hardscape and a few plants and pots. versus more residential styles. So I'll have those to refer to, as well as, again, with the development unit plan, they're going to give us each street and what that streetscape appearance will be like. Parking requirements. Section 14 goes through the parking requirements. Page 14.2.3, you can see some, again, some general pictures that show us the quality and character of parking areas. In exhibit 14.3, which goes pages 14.7-9, they're actually laying out the parking requirements by different types of uses. We've compared this to what we currently have in the city and are comfortable with these standards. They've also provided for bicycle parking to ensure that that's provided in this situation. And then something else that's a little bit unique, it's used other places, and we see it in section 14.6 and exhibit 14.6 is shared parking. Again, we're in an urban situation. We're going to have uses. When you look at the table on 14, 15, 14, 16, might have uses that are used in a parking lot at different times of the day, different days of the week. And so this allows us then to look at how that parking's being shared and reduce the parking by use because of the way the different operations happen. Design review of the elevations. Again, that site plan design review occurs together at the same time. So we'll have the development unit design guidelines to help us with that, as well as, you know, going back to those pictures, as Gordon was talking about a minute ago, with the exhibits back in Section 7, give us a lot of information about that character and quality of materials that we should be looking for as developments occur on various sites. So with the site plan, who approves it? We learned that in Section 6.1E, it's either going to be the P&Z board or the staff. And 6.4E lays out the criteria of what's a major site plan and what's a minor site plan. This is on page 6.4. Major site plans are the ones that go to the Planning and Zoning Board. And so when we look down those criteria and think about the specific site that we have, it was not a mixed-use project on 5 acres, so that wouldn't catch it. It was less than 50,000 square feet. But when we get down to the last one, F, it is on an arterial. So on an arterial street, it would go to the P&Z board. So P&Z board would be reviewing this one. Pre-submittal is required, public notice and writing and posting the site is required with these site plans. One of the unique things that we have developed with regard to site plan review is this idea of site plan development potential. We had some concerns, and I've heard a little bit of it discussed today, of what happens if we just build to the minimums. And how are we going to be monitoring that? And how do we address that transition over time of development of a property? And so the site plan development potential is what was developed for that. We look back at the site plan that we presented a minute ago. It showed a larger lot with a building in the corner and that parking area. That's done so that we can see what they're specifically proposing at this time, but then they'll also submit a conceptual site plan for the rest of that property to show over time how they envision it evolving, so that we're addressing the full development potential of the site. So we can see a plan here for additional two-story, another three-story, a 14-story mixed-use tower, and how that parking structure could be integrated into that site, meeting the different design guidelines and standards for the property to make maximum use of the property. And that gets calculated in with the land use budget tracker so that we can account for that as we go forward and see where the different development potential is going to happen over time. So that's one of the unique things that's provided for in Chapter 6, or Section 6.
Councilmember Richens?
Or questions, kind of, I was anticipating you flipping to that slide. Well, one of the questions I have is this is really different for the city of Mesa, radically different for the city of Mesa. What's our plan for training our building inspectors and all those different folks on how to recognize this and get out of their current box and be able to evaluate this when they've been so used to evaluating our current Euclidean, suburban, sprawling development patterns?
Mayor, Councilmember Richens, that's a very good question that we've been so involved at this stage that I'm not sure we've given enough thought to yet. But we have been, in terms of the zoning staff, thinking about it a little bit and how we are going to be using them and training them for the initial stages of reviewing the development unit plans and the site plans. but I've got an excellent backup here who's going to talk about that next level. So
excellent backup.
Ooh. I've actually given that a lot of thought. That is going to be a huge challenge, and that's actually, I think, the model that we sent with Laura here, that we have certain staff members within the department or within the various city departments that become experts in these areas, that they absolutely become the content experts on the uniqueness of this development so that we keep it moving forward, we keep it on that expedited kind of process as opposed to bogging it down because it is different. But I think it's primarily staff training and having designated people that are going to be the experts here and that are going to take it on, and that's basically what we've asked Laura to do in these initial stages.
Mayor, if I might. I think that goes for our citizen boards and committees too, especially our planning and zoning board. They are not trained at all. I mean, and we have incredibly bright people on our zoning boards, but I mean, I'm not trained even how to recognize some of these things coming through. And so I just want to make sure that we're thinking about that as a very important component, that we're continually training staff and our citizen advisory boards and really community-wide how to recognize some of this innovation that's taking place.
Thank you, Ms. Solanka. Not bad for a backup.
You're welcome, sir.
Mr. Sheffield.
If I could add to Councilmember Richard's comments, one of the things that this plan does is it tends to consolidate both the design review function and the P&Z function in one board. Part of the reason for doing that is because of the differences in this particular type of project versus other types of project. And the idea would be that you'd have a particular citizens board that would be seeing these on a regular enough basis that they would become the citizen expert. Yeah. And kind of the gatekeeper, so to speak, okay, of the project from the citizen standpoint in addition to the staff.
So are we writing in, I have this planned community district chapter in front of me that I've been reading through. Are you saying that we'll have like a downtown development committee type group that's separate from our current planning and zoning board, but we'll use the existing infrastructure that will use this?
Yes, that's correct. We'd use the existing P&Z board.
Well, really, the nuts and bolts will happen at the staff level, and the presentation will be made to P&Z, the standard will be, does it conform with this document?
Correct.
And so I think that's the one thing that will sort of become self-policing and self-training, in the sense that we'll constantly, if we do it right, come back to this is the standard. How does it relate to this document? Which is why pictures and graphs and things all of a sudden become very important. The idea being that when you have written or verbiage, three of us can really look at that and come up to a different conclusion as to exactly what that verbiage really means. Whereas if we're looking at a graph and a picture, you're much more likely to say, okay, we see basically the same thing. Or it seems like it limits the ability to misinterpret, because you're comparing it with something that's graphical.
Sure.
So I think that the thing that makes this type of thing work and maybe overcomes that gap is the fact that it is, in many ways, very complex, but it's reduced to a very simple approach, which was, how does it fit in with the guidelines in here? And you're not having to reach outside this and apply some other standard. Councilmember.
And do we want to consider how we statutorily make up our planning and zoning board? If design review is not going to be part of this, I mean, we need to be recognized that we may need architects or other kind of design professionals on that planning and zoning board consistently that can recognize, even translate for a layperson like me, the picture to, I mean, that's, what is that, 1,000 words to to what it means. So just a thought.
Thank you for that thought. Next item.
Mayor, that's it. We're done with our presentation. Okay. Those other questions.
Councilmember Summers.
No question, but to follow up on what I discussed earlier, I need some more information from staff, and perhaps DMB might want to provide it as well. And that is to look at the job-to-resident ratio. I would like to know what the difference is between the 8.55 million square feet and 20 million square feet as jobs. I did a really bad calculation, but I think when we were calculating office, it's one job per 400 square feet, which if I divide it out by the, I think we're looking at the 8.55, we're looking at 21,375,000 jobs, but the problem with that number is it's not all office space. Retail has a different number, warehousing has a different number, so I'm curious as to what the vision is for this area as far as how that 8.55 million to 20 million square feet of space is going to be utilized in a mix of retail, office space, et cetera, what the number is going to be for that job, and then I would like to take a look at how that balances out with the maximum 15,000 dwelling units and what that job to resident ratio ultimately would be, what the salaries might look like over over time. And I know we can run those numbers, so if I can get that information, thank you.
Thank you, Councilmember. Any other questions or comments? Councilmember Richens?
I do want to make sure that we get a definition of sustainability in here somewhere, because that's used a lot in all the documents, and not just environmental sustainability, but economic sustainability and all the different things. I just really think we need to know what that means when people are throwing it around, especially not only in our planned community chapter, but also within they just looking at their glossary of terms, and I don't think I saw in their even in their glossary of terms a definition of sustainability. So let's just boil that down in terms of the different ways it can be applied.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, Councilmember Richens, one of the areas of emphasis that we as a council agreed on in our recent retreat was that we were going to make sustainability and even green building a point of emphasis as we move forward. I think we have a real opportunity here to work with the applicant to come up with some standards and to make this truly a community for the 21st century, and also one that can be a standard bearer for future development in the city. So I think that's something we probably need to address on an ongoing basis, but also get more specific. Don't want to hold up the whole process, but it's something we probably need to address. Anything else? I would like to thank staff and DMB. I can't even imagine the amount of work, thought. This is incredible. As Councilmember Richens said, this is pretty big deal for us and how we've approached things in the past and how we are going to approach things in the future. And I don't want to underemphasize what a seismic change this is, and in a good way. It's great to be thinking on the edge and to create both a place and a process that is truly leading edge. And thank you so very much for all the work you've been put in. Jill, Grady, and DMB, who else is back there?
Trevor.
Oh, okay.
The guy who wrote it.
I'm sorry? The guy who wrote it. The author. Why is he hiding then? No, this really is, and this isn't the end all, but this is a very impressive effort, and I want to tell you how much I appreciate, and I think I speak for the others, the same. Thank you so very much for your commitment. Thank you for your confidence in Mesa, in our community, in our city, in city staff, and with what's gone on in the last week or so, we are very excited. Now, we want to make sure that we look at this carefully, because we are setting up a framework that's got to last. It's got to stand the test of time, and it's got to be balanced with the needs and the rights of the private company individual, and those rights with the community, because we're the ones that long term. This community is one of the long term that has to deal with the issues such as jobs, sustainability, and the ongoing overall quality of the community. So. This is an awesome start. So thank you very much. We really appreciate that. Okay, next item on the agenda. Acknowledge receipt of minutes of various boards and committees. Moved by Council Member Summers. Seconded by the Vice Mayor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Reports of meetings and or conferences attended. Okay. Oh, yeah, Council Member Richens.
I actually got a tour of the new Rio Tinto mine in Superior yesterday, and got to see what they were trying to accomplish out there, and there's a lot of legislation, and it's going to have an effect on the eastern edges of our community, but this Rio Tinto, the mine that's in Superior, that's reopening or proposed to reopen. So
yeah, I think it'll have a major impact on what happens out in the east side, so thank you. Anything else? Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor. Just remind the council, we will have our next study session will be September 18th. Followed by a Monday, September 22nd study session and council meeting. Just also looking ahead to the end of the year, right now we have meetings in December scheduled for the 1st and the 15th. We've had a request to consider moving up the 15th council meeting to December 8th to give a longer break during the holidays, if that's agreeable with the council. We'd be doing two consecutive meetings.
Is anybody going to complain about that?
Very good. Okay. So
you may not be here on the 8th? Is it okay if we meet without you, or?
I think it's a wonderful idea.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
I didn't think you'd object. Okay, Ms. Anderson, any requests to speak from citizens?
No requests.
Okay.
Mayor, real quick.
Mr. Brady.
We were talking about the strategic planning workshop we had. In your packets this week, you will have the summaries of that are being provided by the consultants. What we're now doing as staff is internally is we're going to take these and then we're going to come back to council with a recommended action plan, I think is what the consultants refer to that. And they've actually given us some examples, been done in other communities. And then we'll bring that back to the council so you can see how we would propose either with existing programs or other initiatives to begin the implementation of the summary that was provided. So I just want to give you a heads up that you'll start seeing that.
Thank you. There being no further business, entertain a motion to adjourn.
I already did.
Oh, you already did. And we already have a second. And you already approved. Boy, you got 5 steps ahead of me.